Okay, we're doing our next installment on the book called Marshall McLuhan's Mosaic, subtitled Probing the Literary Origins of Media Studies, written by the Italian professor Elena Lamberti. Now, we have done a good chunk of the book, gone through a lot of the themes, and now we're getting into what's called part two, the particular individuals that influenced McLuhan. These are the literary performers of the origins of media studies. So the first guy is Ford Madox Ford, a name most people have never heard. So, Carolyn, what do you have on your notes on that?
Right. It's chapter 9, Ford Madox Ford, Not Mere Chat.
It's a subtitle,
and then the first subheading is Literature Matters. So what we have to realize is Lamberti is a literature professor, so that's what she's going to be focusing on, and she's making the, making the case that McLuhan was influenced by these literary greats. And she makes a good case and all, but I guess there's much more to the story. What was good for me is I never had a chance to read literature or do anything but medicine my whole life. So it's kind of fun for me to go through this book. And actually, I don't think we'll ever get to this other book that I'm reading right now, but Bob, I was thinking it kind of reminds me of reading The Metaphysical Club. The Metaphysical Club, subtitle, A Story of Ideas in America. This was recommended to us via a lecture by a lawyer friend of us who worked with Ralph Nader back in the day. So anyway, in this Metaphysical Club, The Story of Ideas, it goes through guys like Oliver Wendell Holmes and who's the next one?
Aziz.
Yeah, Aziz was the second one. And just the kind of the philosophers, I guess.
William James.
Yeah, William James. And I think it was probably Bert earlier in today's session here. Bert said anything he reads, he can't help but put it through the lens of Ian and Bob. And it's the same with looking at Ford Madox Ford. It's the same looking at Oliver Wendell Holmes or any of these so-called greats that we take our cues from. Because when you read about them, they're puny. They really are puny. The whole thing about what forms American ideas was influenced very greatly by the Civil War. Who went to war and who didn't go to war? You know, whether you went or you didn't go formed the way you thought about the universe, and that formed the mythologies and philosophies and psychology of America. And that's not deep thinking. It's you're either brave and courageous, but you get horrified by the war, or you don't go to war and you're guilty because you didn't, and that forms your worldview. But nobody looks any deeper than a superficial cut. What do you think of that, Bob?
Good, fine, well done.
Okay, Literature Matters. So this. Okay, the first letter here. Who's writing this letter, Bob? Because my
Marshall McLuhan's writing to Ezra Pound in November 1948. He has just met Pound in June.
Right. So McLuhan is saying, "Dear Pound, my epistolary." So what does epistolary mean?
Letter writing.
Ah, yes, epistle. My epistolary socks have sagged lately.
Meaning he hasn't written a letter lately.
All right. you know, going through Ford Madox Ford and trying to read all that he says I must has given me quite a feeling of inadequacy and irrelevance. That will pass by the time I've finished the next 200 volumes. But the sense of only now reading things I should have known all along has sapped me, S-A-P-P-E-D me. And to write to yourself, who have for 45 years taken for granted all this learning, perception, and art, comma, well, it seems sheer impertinence. That's kind of cute.
To write the pound. That's like Bert saying, Bob, when I realize what you were saying 30 and 40 years ago, I have to apologize for even speaking to you.
Uh-huh.
Same. But I've been talking about for 40 years, has just shown up in the White House.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, Lamberti then jumps in, says, Ford Madox Ford was a guardian divinity of belles lettres. So, good letters.
Literature. Belles lettres was the art for the Europe.
Literature. One of those writers who contribute to the spiritual well-being of all those who are in love with creative writing, modernist scholars, or aficionados of literature alike. And jumping down to the next paragraph, beginning with the When Cultural Trends paragraph, the statement, statements such as only from the arts can any safety for the future of the state be found, and the public of today has to go to the imaginative writer for its knowledge of life, for its civilization, comfort us. So that's what Ford was known for, is writing, but with a purpose, I guess you could say.
Well, he knew that information and culture were going to take over in determining the mental health of the body politic. At least that's what he hoped. He'd be shocked at how it turned out.
Shush. Oh, yeah. Now, just jumping down a couple of lines, his writing, yeah, through his light writing, he says that literature, or Lamberti is quoting him as saying, literature stands as the only civilizing agency that is at work today as in other dark ages, because you cannot have a business community of any honesty unless you have a literature to set and maintain a high standard, no matter if these...
Now, that's the end of the quote.
Yeah.
And then Elena says...
Go ahead.
No matter if these hyperbolic and absolute assertions, these emotive utterances are perceived by the majority of people as mere illusions, and it matters even less if some mathematicians find these utterances to be false. To us, who accept the fact that in the poetic approach, logic comes in, if at all, in subordination as servant to our emotional response, they resonate as true. Literature matters, and literature is a very serious business. So she loves starting off with Ford Madox Ford, because that means that her profession of teaching literature is relevant.
Right. And jumping down to the next, some tiny paragraphs here, but... To date, critics have neglected the role played by Ford in shaping the way in which Marshall McLuhan employed the arts and literature as analogical mirrors, casting light on ongoing cultural, technological, and social processes. But then I guess she tries to prove that Ford was important and that he was neglected. But I don't know that you've ever talked about Ford Madox Ford, and you're a McLuhan scholar.
Right. No, I was aware of him and read a bit about him through the years. McLuhan mentions him in criticism about once back in the Renaissance days, but no big deal. Only important if you think Lewis and Pound and Eliot are important. The whole London scene, Ford was the leader of it.
Oh,
at the end of the, well, in the middle of the first decade. And it's who Wyndham Lewis went to get his first writing published after he traveled around Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's an important guy, but he got killed in... No, he didn't get killed, but he got sidelined pretty quickly after World War One. so mm-hmm. that he's actually crying, I think Elena reports, by the end of the 30s, he's crying that he's been forgotten and all the people that he raised and grew, all the Borges mm-hmm. are, you know, famous people.
Yeah, so his years are 1873 to June 1939.
Right. So he, you know, Joyce and Lewis are born in 1882, so he's 10 years older, 9 years older. He might have had a few important things, but he put too much stake in literature.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't see what Pound and Joyce saw in terms of the post-literate world that was coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Post-book world. But
yeah.
But for universities, he's an important guy.
I guess. They have to keep reading something.
Yeah.
So going down to the next paragraph that begins with today, I go down a few lines and we pick up with, Ford's project was to renew English letters and realign them with the good literature of the time, which in his own view was coming from France as a counterbalance to Zola, namely the imaginative literature of Flaubert, Maupassant, and the symbolist poets. To pursue his dream of an international republic of letters, Ford edited two literary reviews, English Review and the Transatlantic Review. So that's what you're saying is he would make other writers popular by reviewing their works.
Yeah.
So he was in a pivotal position, but then he didn't move along with them. He stayed stuck.
Yes, but he might have remained more active. I don't know what he actually did from 1924 till 39. Probably had some role, but the people who were avant-garde were nowheres. Joyce was in poverty. Pound was, isolated in Italy. Lewis was ignored. You know, the people that are really important are not doing as well as he is in a way mm-hmm. in the 20s and 30s. Eventually they do, but it's a curious situation. And the media aspects of the Vorticists, nobody even knows. They don't really know what Pound and Eliot and Joyce and Lewis are on about. It wasn't until McLuhan came along to say what they did. So it's all part of the first half of the 20th century, a period of great confusion. I'm reading Vincent Sherry's book on the Great War, World War I, and how it influenced the language of modernism, the language of Pound and Eliot and Virginia Woolf. And it's really important, and he shows that Pound wrote a certain kind of poetry at the beginning of World War I, but the public communications of the government during the war in England were so ridiculous that Pound becomes a whole different kind of writer within 3 years to mirror the change in public communication. So all of the avant-garde styling and incomprehensible ways that Pound wrote that later went into Eliot and Joyce was caused by the media environment of World War I. So that's an important insight about that period. And the guy who writes it, Vincent Sherry, was a student of McLuhan in the 70s. But he doesn't use McLuhan at all. He just talks about what was going on in the media, in the content of all mm-hmm. kinds of incredible stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Basic incompetence in communication by the liberal government of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So it was so wacky that it forced Pound, Joyce, and Lewis to start writing wacky too, just to keep up.
Whereas Ford, he was mainly being the librarian for these guys.
Yeah.
Just before the quote, the quote starting with the major one, just before that, it's Lamberti says, in the promo that Ford wrote and circulated at the end of 1923 to launch his forthcoming Transatlantic Review, Ford wrote of the dual goal he pursued as an editor. So the major, end quote, the major one, the purely literary, conducing to the minor, the disinterestedly social. The first is that of widening the field in which the younger writers of the day can find publication. The second, that of introducing international politics, a note more genial than that which almost universally prevails. The first conduces to the second in that the best ambassadors, the only non-secret diplomatists between nations are the books and the arts of nations. So was he a peacenik then? Was he trying to dampen down the talk of war? This is in 23 he's writing.
Well, it says here in the next paragraph, in spite of Ford's commitment and his persistent generosity towards younger writers, most of his young protégés revolted against Ford over time, often denouncing his excessive paternalism as well as his ambiguous take towards tradition. So he was operating in the interval. I don't know what his position on the war was, but I guess it was probably ambivalent. It says, Ford never embraced the most extreme avant-garde credos against the past. Mm-hmm. And in contrast with most radical modernist isms, he based his poetics on a constant dialogue among literary and artistic traditions, which is, in Vincent Cherry's book, is about the liberal gentlemanly tradition, the dialogue, keeping the dialogue going is the most important thing. So he's of that tradition. He advocated an important dialogue, a genteel dialogue in a way, among the various arts and literature. So he's a nice guy, and the world was getting no longer interested in nice guys, nice literate guys.
And that paragraph ends with Lambert is saying, there was one protege, Ezra Pound, who always acknowledged his debt toward Ford, toward Ford's teaching, and always defended Ford's role as a writer and thinker. It is through Ezra Pound that the young Marshall McLuhan encountered Ford, Ford's work and ideas. So that begins the next subheading, an imaginative writer. And I don't know if you came across this, but this is where McLuhan acknowledges Ford in the sense that he says, or she says, in 1948, McLuhan wrote in a letter to Pound, quote, can you or Mrs. Pound tell me why T.S. Eliot carefully suppresses all references to Ford or his writing? There must be some explanation. My interest in the matter is not at the gossip level. It seems to me to be necessary for an understanding of 20th century.
Letters.
20th century letters, yeah. And then at the end of that paragraph, what Ford envisaged, bracket, already in his 1909-10 editorials, bracket, is a new idea of realism, as in Flaubert and Maupassant, mirroring a new type of writer. So, okay, I mean, what more do we need to say about this this chapter, Bob? As in mirroring a new type of writer. Now, is this Ford's quote?
Which one?
It will be observed that this elevates a novelist.
No, that's Ford.
Yeah, so Ford's quote, it will be observed that let's see what that means. That this elevates the novelist of this school to the rank of a scientific observer. His business is to lay before the reader the results not of his moral theories, not of his socially constructed ideas, not even of his generous impulses, nor even of his imagination, but simply the results of his observation of life. So he's just painting a two-dimensional picture.
No, he's... this is 1909. He is very ready to understand what the new upsetting people like Joyce, Eliot, and Pound are going to do. He's describing them as the scientific observer, and T.S. Eliot uses those kind of ideas 12, 15 years later when he writes about Joyce's Ulysses. He says Joyce makes as important discovery as Einstein does. Like the discovery of Einstein, the physicists who explore that, they're allowed to talk about or repeat Einstein's thoughts and ideas and experiments. They're not accused of plagiarism. And Eliot says it's the same case with Joyce's breakthroughs. Writers will come along that will build up, will develop the patterns that Joyce laid out, the same kind of method. so they can't be accused of plagiarism like scientists aren't accused of it.
Hmm.
So Ford sees that. He says it will be observed that this elevates the novelist of this school to the rank of a scientific observer. These are important early understandings of relevant to criticism, to mm-hmm. literary criticism, and to whatever new forms of invention come from that. Because Joyce, Pound, and Elliot Lewis are creators. They write fiction, but they're also critics, learned mm-hmm. critics. So they straddle both. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Ford Madison Ford was maybe the model of that. He was a novelist, but also a critic. So his ideas are okay for anticipating what happens in the 20s and 30s. But what happens to Joyce and Lewis and Pound is like devastation, tragedy to what happens to these people because of the later environments that are coming that Ford Madox Ford couldn't live through. He died in 1939. So actual chaos and violence that's coming, Joyce really expresses it well in Finney's Wake. Took a guy like McLuhan. Who's like McLuhan? So we should change that. It took McLuhan to figure out what Ford Madox Ford only glimpsed.
Right. So she begins with Ford because he's sort of the present of that day. And is sort of
the present?
Yeah, he was just he's an example of what Elliot and Pound and Lewis and McLuhan were not. He was just a literary guy. He did, as you said, see something was afoot, and he thought, well, let's just observe it. He didn't want to jump into the fray, and so he was. He wasn't even the lead up to what was going to happen. He was just the observer of it.
Well, she says, Elena says, hence, to appreciate the impact of Ford on McLuhan's writing is not simply a pedantic academic exercise. On the contrary, it becomes a useful link for further understanding and clarifying the literary origins of McLuhan's media and communication studies, both in terms of the operative project to explore and investigate his own times and the form through which it is enacted, that is, the mosaic built to provoke and not to comfort his readers. It is a way to retrieve the role played by the humanities, not only in relation to the process of understanding the ways in which our high-tech society developed, is also a way to assert the importance of tracing a constant fil rouge connecting literature to the world, text to context, figure to ground. So she's fitting Ford into her agenda about mm-hmm. the important literary roots of McLuhan, and that's true, but McLuhan is also greatly influenced by Eisenstein, the mm-hmm. Russian filmmaker, and Moholy Nagy, and other non-literary artists, mm-hmm. and scientists, and sociologists. Cameron McEwen does great scholarship on the several professors at the University of Manitoba who have a profound effect on McLuhan that nobody has noticed.
Mm.
And it's interesting, these professors came from the University of Chicago, which was the same university under Robert, forget his last name, Robert somebody, who had a big influence on Harold Innes. So you got two schools in a way here. You got those that will begin with Innes and McLuhan and go into modern media technologies. And then you got the other school that says, no, McLuhan was a poet, and let's look at the poets that he got his most sustenance and nutrition from.
Mm-hmm.
That's the argument. Well, Elena feels that it's a little unbalanced, and they need to emphasize the literary origins. So Ford Madox Ford is brought into it as the beginning of the literary innovations.
Mm-hmm.
So he's an important guy, but that's only on the book side of things.
Right. So that's what, like one-fifth, one-sixth of McLuhan's influences, literature?
Yeah. I was making a list in my mind, walking to the beach. You could say it begins, the influences on McLuhan or what he studied intently were Catholic thinkers, beginning with G.K. Chesterton in the 30s, and then the Protestant thinkers at Cambridge, and then, unless Leavis and Richards are Catholic, I don't know, but they're in a Protestant culture, and all the time they're teaching, McLuhan's railing against this environment at Cambridge, saying its big mistake is that it's Protestant. It made a big mistake in Britain when they fell for Protestantism. Anyways, he has a new kind of influence in 1940. He reads Siegfried Gideon's Space, Time, and Architecture, and he says that was one of the major experiences of his life. Hmm. So Gideon comes in and serves as a model throughout the 40s, and then McLuhan meets Wyndham Lewis in 43, and that's another big influence. Then McLuhan in the mid-40s is doing in-depth study of Eliot, so he's influenced by Eliot a lot. But that gets sort of canceled when he meets Ezra Pound in the late 40s. So that becomes a big influence. And then he meets Ted Carpenter, who brings in the anthropological influences and knowledge of the Eskimos or the Inuit. And then he finds Harold Innes, which caps off his art form. So that's the string here. And that's of writers and thinkers. Now you've got the other arts, movies and advertising, radio phenomena, all that McLuhan is paying attention to.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to see that McLuhan was a very open-minded person in terms of observing a lot of stuff going on in his global village, global media village, not quite a theater yet. So that's the way a full book would write about McLuhan, but maybe that would be too big a book. Mm-hmm. So we have this chip off the old block here about Ford, Maddox, Ford.
Right.
I mean, I'm not thinking about what Ford, Maddox, Ford's doing and said when I apply my paramedia ecology to the present world. You know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I am thinking about Pound and Joyce.
Right. Yeah, so I don't know, again, I don't know how much more you want to go into this. She even says under the subheading Things, Not Words, the second paragraph, sentence or two down, as yet, for Ford's alert readers, this lack of direct references in McLuhan's major books is somehow compensated for by the constant presence of several indirect references. McLuhan's pages resound with expressions which echo in the scholar's ear and form a sort of Fordian progression de effect.
Right, de effect. Now, McLuhan says that great artists leave out their major influences.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, you know, Ford's a big deal because McLuhan didn't talk about him.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be some phrases, but you got to look at McLuhan as a polymath in a sense that he remembered a lot of things from a lot of sources. So he would sprinkle stuff from everybody throughout his writings. But I've underlined a lot in this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see if I can find a couple of...
Well, the form and content business, go on two or more paragraphs. The paragraph that begins after what McLuhan himself confessed. I clip the part that says he used an expression that McLuhan himself used, which reflects one of Ford's most famous impressionist tenets. In turn, based on his study of Flaubert's new style, as carried on during his collaboration with Joseph Conrad. The expression was used by Ford to emphasize the important role played by form in the creation of content. It is another ante literatum way to say that the medium is the message, to select and juxtapose words in a conscious act that the writer performs to cast a form capable of driving the reader towards impromptu epiphanies, irrespective of the plot or content. So she's putting words in his mouth in terms of form content, which McLuhan employed.
Well, what are you saying? What's the word?
Form and content.
No, no. For instance, Father Lawrence Dewan, who was one of McLuhan's assistants in the 1950s, recalls the importance that McLuhan gave to the search for le mot juste,
uh-huh.
French for the right word. He uses an expression that McLuhan himself used, and which reflects one of Ford's most famous impressionist tenets, in turn based on a study of Flaubert's new style as carried on during his collaboration with Joseph Conrad. The expression was used by Ford to emphasize the important role played by form in the creation of content. So it's the phrase le mot juste, apparently,
yes,
that
the best word.
Ford drew McLuhan's attention to.
Okay. Understood, but yeah, what's the best word? What's this whole business about medium as a message then? So she's saying they're looking at the word is the message?
Is the medium. To select and to juxtapose words is a conscious act that the writer performs to cast a form capable of driving the reader towards impromptu epiphanies, irrespective of the plot or content. So the effect of collage creates a medium, an effect of like a medium impression,
mm-hmm.
an environmental impression. So she then says, Ford's most famous novel, The Good Soldier, embodies the major technical devices which Ford elaborated to make us see, hear, and feel. They are, quote, juxtaposition of situations, progression of effect, time shift, and, of course, the perennial search for the right word, le mot juste. The word with the most juice is how Barry Nevitt used to translate it. You know, the le mot is French for word, and just is appropriate. Le mot juste, the appropriate word, or the word with the most juice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yeah, what have you got underlined?
Okay. The first, okay, these, he has some quotes. McLuhan talking about Ford and how important Ford is in his correspondence with his friend Felix Giovanelli. Then she says, Lamberti says, these brief passages show that McLuhan had clearly understood three major aspects of Ford's poetics, three aspects which later will pervade his own as well. The first, Ford Maddox Ford deals with res, in brackets things, that is facts and actuality, with clear reference to a concrete use of language, which implies a careful process of selection of le mot juste. So he deals with res, that's things, rather than verba, here to be understood as abstractions or redundant and soft words. So he's saying, she's saying that Ford directed McLuhan to looking at objects and maybe then media.
Mm-hmm.
She then says, that is, Ford uses language in a new way, conveying to language a natural and concrete quality as other modernist poetics will later do. For example, Pound's Imagism. The second aspect, Ford considers literature and storytelling not as a mere divertisement or distraction, nor as a preaching strategy, though it's not moralist, but as an active component of his observation of his own time. Then there's a quote, his anecdotes always point to social, political, economic, aesthetic axes and dynamics within a situation. That's a quote from McLuhan. So McLuhan learned to look at the social, political, economic, aesthetic axis and dynamics within a situation, so looking at the ground. The third, Ford adopts a comparative and broad approach to develop his observations, thus turning literature into a tool to approach various aspects of an ever-growing complex society. So people read books for amusement, for diversion, for sentiments, for nostalgia, for propping up their belief systems, and Ford saying, no, we use books as a key to, or the real books, the important books, as a key to what's going on in society. So that's like looking at, you know, creativity as a direct antenna view of what's happening in society. So to the degree that that was said uniquely by him in those ways, and McLuhan read them and perhaps was influenced by them, don't know if he would require that. This case is valid. Because McLuhan does say in a couple of few places how important Ford is.
Mm-hmm.
He says this, Ford's memoirs are not mere chat. The chat is a series of epiphanies of carefully considered social and literary structures and their interpenetration. That's media.
Mm-hmm.
One group of artifacts affecting another. So you can find interesting sentences in Ford's work that she, Elena says, is a guide to how McLuhan started to look at things.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know if you could say that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, McLuhan may already have figured that out because he's reading this guy pretty late, 1948, 49, 50. McLuhan's already looking at environments, and he actually gave a talk back in 1940, according to Peter Drucker, where he said essentially the medium is the message. Drucker said he didn't say those words, but McLuhan meant that by what Drucker remembers the talk was about. That's 1940, 41,
mm-hmm.
long before he read Ford. So I think by the late 40s, McLuhan is sort of on to what he's going to do, and he's delighted to find people spelling it out for him,
mm-hmm.
validating what he was thinking about.
Okay. So scanning ahead, I have a lot of things that I've highlighted that I was learning when I wrote them, but it's a lot of repetition.
Mm-hmm. So we'll name one of them. Do one of them.
Page 164, the paragraph starting, a similar strategy of exploration.
Okay.
And a few lines down, in his editorials, Ford denounces the increasing dominance of what he called accepted ideas, in italics. He sees these as a side effect of the new era of mass communications that is characterizing the passage from the 19th to the 20th century, when new technological developments changed the way news was distributed and started the process which now we now define as information overload. So I thought that was interesting. He was denouncing accepted ideas, but from what we're learning about Ford, that he was pretty conventional.
Well, he accepted ideas are like memes, mm-hmm. before the word memes. So he is judgmental and holding up the standard of perspective that literacy engenders,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't like the destruction of that honorable tradition by new media, whereas McLuhan looks at media without favoritism.
I see.
He looks at the dynamics of each one of them, which is outrageous for fellow university professors, but that's what he pioneered. He looked at media developments without sort of trying to preserve anything other than society in general, since the new media were just wrecking society way beyond what people expected. And he thought, well, maybe we should back off a bit on this innovation process,
mm-hmm.
and have a little sober media fast. But he is not necessarily, he's not trying to preserve certain ideas, or he's not even trying to preserve the tradition of literature. He just thinks that literature has a value as a particular medium and should be in the mix of people's media diet. But he sees that the environment is undermining that 100%. I mean, McLuhan goes so far as to say that there's no ground to be a Christian anymore.
Mm.
Think of that.
Mm.
He's saying, and I try to tell this to a Christian who has all kinds of emotional or intellectual ideas about why they're a Christian, moral ideas, and McLuhan says, well, you can't be a Christian today because Christianity is founded on the phonetic alphabet and its particular fragmenting effect and detaching effect, especially enhanced by the printed book. And since that has no effect on people in terms of their ingrained constitutive perceptual patterning and conditioning, then the whole Christian enterprise is obsolete. It cannot be applied. So when something's obsolete, there's more and more of it. So the spread of fundamentalism in all the different manuscript religions, including Christianity, is what we've witnessed. And when you can't be a Christian anymore, in the real sense, based on the literary effect, then you have nothing but more and more people claiming they're Christian. Right? Because it's obsolete. There's going to be more and more of them. So that's why I say that McLuhan actually was hinting on a new way to be a Christian. How can you be it if the ground for that perception can't be passed on to the next generation?
Right, right, right.
So that's never said. People just talk about, well, McLuhan was a Catholic, therefore there must be something to Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
But he spent his life criticizing the church for being unaware of the new questions and strategies that Christians are going to have to develop.
Okay, so here it is. just skip the next long quote, and the paragraph begins, the overload of information.
And wait a minute, let me find that. Oh, yeah, I got that, yep.
Information induced by the telegraphic press and later by the wireless radio is presented by Ford as a constant, continuous, and even voracious flow of data which blurs categories and classifications and contributes to a superficial approach to both facts and the analysis of facts. So, yeah, he's going after information overload.
Yes, and maybe it's not strange to notice this information overflow. But maybe the average person isn't thinking about it. It's just enjoying the information overflow with their new movie and radio and telephone environments.
Right.
But he's saying it is it's disrupting facts and the analysis of facts. He's still preserving on the POB, print-oriented bastard, standard of reality, mm-hmm. that there are facts. And modern media destroy the knowledge, remembrance of facts. Well, it's... a new kind of fact is being made by the new media.
Yeah, so he's just looking at content, fake news.
But he's kind of moving towards bringing in form. But at best, this is the first guy noticing a problem, and he's good at it, but there's got to be a lot of development beyond what he did.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to say there was a beginning point, he did... he was the mentor to Pound and Lewis and Elliot in a way. So he's important in that sense.
Yeah.
Do we need to remember him for that? I don't know. I don't know if we have time to remember anybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So just after that, and I'm trying to get back. I keep losing the page. It talks about can you read just a few sentences below? It talks about the popular press or the common press, how he doesn't like that.
A quote from him?
Yeah, I'm almost there. I touched the screen the wrong way and I lose everything.
I mean, the struggle with the Boers that made the fortune of the more frivolous press?
No, Ford, just right below where we read in his editorials, Ford encourages his readers to rebel against what he calls the halfpenny press, to resist all brainwashing, and to regain a true critical attitude or free will. He laments that the days of most rapid traveling are the days of most frequent misunderstandings between the races of mankind, mostly because accepted ideas spread through new processes of communication are replacing individual and original thinking. So he's developing a little bit of desire for media ecology.
Yeah, but he is trying to preserve the individual. Pound in...